Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, American Girl, from their debut album, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And it was recorded and mixed at the Shelter Studio in Hollywood, California, and released on the 9th of November 1976 on the Shelter record label. It was also released as a single in February 1977, but it didn't chart in the United States. But it peaked at number 40 in the UK, the week ending 27th of August 1977.
Well, I'll go to the bottom of our stairs. That's what my grandma used to say.
What do you mean?
Well, it's just that's an exclamation. I go to the bottom of our... Well, I'll go to the bottom of our stairs. Anyway, let's not talk about stairs. Let's talk about Denny Cordell, who actually produced it and who signed him originally to Shelter.
Yeah.
And Denny Cordell, of course, was the mentor to Tony Visconti. We got the book. But you haven't read the book yet.
No, I haven't.
No, you haven't.
I've been busy.
And Denny Cordell actually produced the first Moody Blues single, Gonna,
right.
before the Magnificent Moodies, before they changed into the Magnificent Fantastic Moody Blues, the first track that they did.
Yeah.
And if you remember with the Moodies, what happened is that they did the first album, and then, you know, they were hanging around in all these suits and stuff, and the popularity went and went and went and went, and they didn't write that song originally.
No.
And eventually, in the van on the way back from a gig where they'd been virtually booed off in the northeast, they said, that was crap, wasn't it? That was the drummer, I think he said, in the back, and everybody agreed.
Yeah.
And they decided to, you know, do the new Moody Blues, and that the rest is history. But anyway, Denny Cordell.
Yes.
Denny Cordell. He produced it. And Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. What a magnificent song. It's unfortunately, it's like a Radio 2 staple or an American staple, sort of every, you know, everybody plays it. But it's just a great song. And that's the first track that I ever heard of Tom Petty. And they came out around about the same time, of course, as punk. And it sort of, it was a funny thing because they sort of associated with the punk movement. You know, they looked a bit different, and it was quite strident, it, you know, the guitar and everything. What do you think about it?
What really strikes me, you know, when we watched the documentary with Tom Petty and stuff, and especially he's in the Sound City documentary as well, isn't he? So he didn't connect necessarily in the UK in the US initially, but he was on Top of the Pops in the UK.
That's right.
And they played anything that's rock and roll. And he was just saying that the audience jumped up and charged the stage and were booging their brains out. And it was such a rush. They'd never seen anything like it. And that's what I really love about you can sometimes you've got to travel to take your music where it will connect. And
that happened with Hendrix, didn't it? Because Hendrix made it in the, you know.
I'm really... I mean, this is an American staple, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even though it was limited success in the US, it's basically been consistently rated as one of his best songs, one of the best rock songs of all time, apparently. And it's been called more than a classic rock standard. It's practically part of the American literary canon.
Well, let's forget about the production for a moment. Let's talk about Mike Campbell, the guitar player, who is one of my favourite guitar players of all time. No relation, sadly. Mike...
Somewhere you are.
Well, yes.
You've got to be.
In the mists of time.
Exactly.
But he's fantastic. And on this, I love that little lick at the end. And it's a lick that I sort of picked up. I was doing a long time before this, because I started playing around about 74.
Yeah.
And I can't remember where I picked that lick up, but he'd obviously picked it up from the same place I'd picked it up. And I remember hearing that. I thought, he's stolen my lick. Right at the very end. It's a lovely little lick. And he's always got a great guitar sound, and he always plays very appropriately. You know, and we haven't had a lot of Tom Petty on the show so far. And, you know, I think we did when he sadly passed away, but But he's one of those guys that it's very immediate sound, you know. He writes great songs, and, you know, when he's with the Traveling Wilburys and everything he's done, really, it's very immediate, you know. And I just love him, you know. He's a good songwriter.
Yeah, yeah. Who's this now? You're talking about Campbell or Petty?
Petty.
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah. I think so. I think he kind of documented life, and it was very simple, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that his stories were just... people really related to them at the time, and I think still do now.
Yeah, he really has got it, you know, and Denny Cordell picked him up. I don't know what happened after that, because I think there was... I remember watching a documentary, and I think he went to... Because they were in the sort of southeast of the US, sort of by Florida, sort of around that area. I think that's where they grew up. They drove up to Los Angeles.
I love that story. Yeah, that, you know, get in the car and let's go and get a record deal.
And they got a record deal within, you know, they went to two or three companies, and they instantly got a record deal, didn't they?
How cool is that, hey?
How cool is that?
Time goes by, you will see that we're going to be free. You and me will touch the sky. Can you see in your mind's eye that we are one? We're all.
Moody Blues, A Simple Game, was released as a non-album B-side to Ride My Seesaw, a track from their third album, In Search for Lost Chord. The single was released on the 12th of October 1968 on the Durham Record label, which was part of Decca, and recorded at the Decca Studios.
Get in there. I love, love, love the Moody Blues.
They're amazing. And instantly, when that Mellotron comes in, it's like a grunting, you know. It's not, of course, it doesn't sound like strings because it's got a sound. A mellotron has a sound, you know. And, you know, I mean, we talked about mellotrons a lot because basically it's a key which is attached to a mechanical device that pulls a piece of tape.
That's
magnetic
right.
tape through past the record head, and there's a spring at the bottom that actually pulls it back when you take the finger off the key. So you press the key, it activates the roller, it pulls the tape through, and then the spring pulls it back. Very primitive. So it's like the original sampling. But they were masters. Mike Pinder, of course, the keyboard player. He wrote this, didn't he, as well?
Yeah.
And he's the keyboard player.
Indeed.
Marvellous.
I was thinking about the Moody's. I was just having a quick look online, actually, because I know they do like the Blues Cruise tour, and I was like, John Lodge plays separately to Justin Hayward, and they have different lineups of the band, and then they converge. And I know I haven't seen them live yet, but all I know is that this band have changed my musical world. They've given me a reference for... They're so beautiful, they're so complex. And I just... When we played the albums at home, it feels like home in my head, in my heart. I feel totally and utterly connected to the music.
Well, and, we've got about the first five or six albums, haven't we, on vinyl?
Yeah.
And then, but we've also got it's like the best of, and it's a double album, and every track on it is fantastic, isn't it? And we put it on, it starts with Question, and
but you end up just singing along, harmonies, and what was interesting about this, though, that it was a non-album.
I know.
So it wasn't part of any album, it was just put on the B-side to Ride My Seesaw.
But it's a great. I mean, this is a great song, and you know, this second album in Search for Lost Chord is a magnificent record. You know,
yeah.
I think Threshold of a Dream was after that, which was the first one I ever got. And what I like about Durham as well is that because the Days of Future Past, which is the first album that we got, is a Spanish version, isn't it?
It is.
We bought it in Spain.
That's sí, señor.
And it's all
so
in,
true, I forgot about that.
Yeah, because all the writings, of course, and everything's in Spanish. Of course, the vocals, it's the same album, it's in English. But
of course, yeah.
All the Durham records were really thick. They were like 180 gram vinyl. They really cared about the pressing, you know, because the Moody's originally were signed, weren't they? Because the company wanted to release the first stereo album, and Durham was all about, that's the sub-label of Decca, all about releasing stereo records, which are quite unusual then.
It was interesting as well. And do you know how they got their name? Apparently when they first got together... it was the MBs or something. They were trying to get some sponsorship from a pub. I think it was called like the Mitchells and Butlers Brewery
something. Oh, yeah, Mitchell and Butler, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's at the MBs, you see. And, and then it transformed from that. And apparently then somebody said about Mike Pinder was interested in how music changes people's moods, and due to the fact the band was playing a lot of blues at the time, the Moody Blues.
Yeah.
So they had that meaning to it. So can you imagine though? I know, let's call our band Strongbow or something, you know, after cider. Let's get some sponsorship, shall we?
That's a great I didn't know that. And you know, but the thing about the Moody Blues though, it's not just the band, because Tony Clark, the producer, he actually did such a marvelous job all the way through, and as soon as he stopped producing them, it all fell to pieces, because you know, after that I think he did some dreadful albums, but the first lot were just magnificent. And I don't know what he did, because you know, when you listen to them as well, I mean, some of the drum sounds are horrible, you know, but this sort of it works as a unit together. It works as a piece of music together. All the sounds fit in, you know, because it's such a dense sound with that mellotron. It's everywhere, the mellotron, isn't it? They use a lot of 12 string, and it's like, you know, and Justin Edwards' guitar is so good. He's had such a great guitar player, you know. I love
him. He is, isn't he? And I'll tell you what, and they write beautiful songs.
Oh,
Stevie Wonder and Sir Duke from his 18th album and double LP, Songs in the Key of Life, released on the 28th of September in 1976 on the Tamla record label.
Well, recently we've been going through all our vinyl.
We have. Because
we've just moved to our new location in Germany. And we're setting up our studio, and we decided we'd go through all the vinyl we've got, which has been a massive job. And we've been playing all the stuff, haven't we? That we
It's still ongoing.
Yeah, it's still ongoing. It's a mammoth task. And we got music on all day and all night. As we're sort of putting acoustic panels up and doing all the stuff, and you've been painting, and I've been doing all sorts of drilling and
what's been really throwing into the mix as well is that I used to work in radio and I was a presenter for a few years, and one night I got into the station and they basically got rid of all of their vinyl, and there was just a table covered in hundreds and hundreds of vinyl albums and 12 inches and with a note just saying take what you want.
Yeah.
So this was at Signal Cheshire in Stockport, South Manchester. So I ended up just taking like loads of going, oh, I don't know about him. Oh, I've heard about him. And just had loads and loads of vinyl some of the stuff I'd never even played until we played it. And so it's not necessarily been straightforward, love this album or really like this music. We've been on a discovery, haven't we? Who's this? And what's that about? And, you know.
And the problem that we've had with Stevie Wonder is that we've had about three or four albums that we've put on that are utter tosh.
Well, they're just a bit flat.
And mediocre.
Right, so the story is as well that Stevie Wonder was the first ever concert I went to see.
Yes.
When I was 16. And I literally was at the very, very front. And it was the most amazing, life-transforming concert, I think, and I'd ever been. Well, I'd never been to one.
Yeah.
So I was just totally. So when I left, I basically saved up and bought as many albums as I could. So I bought Songs in the Key of Life.
Great album.
And then I went all the way back to Little Stevie Wonder. But there are just some albums in between the beginning and to Songs in the Key of Life that just sort of don't do anything musically for me. They're there, but they're a bit they're just flat.
Yeah.
They go somewhere else.
And his songwriting, when he's on form, there's absolutely no. I mean, this album is sensational, isn't it? And it Barry Gordy. It took so long to record that Barry Gordy had to mortgage his house, didn't he? Or remortgage his house.
I think it was. Yeah, I've just been reading about that as well because I just wanted to double check that with Barry.
Yeah.
What happened was that he was coming up to the end of his Stevie was coming up to the end of his contract in 1975. He announced he was going to retire. He was going to go and work because he has apparently heritage in Ghana. He was going to go there and work with disabled children and just really sort of be more philanthropic with his lifestyle. And then he decided not to do that. And there was this massive war. I think other labels were getting involved. And he had the best deal in the whole history of the music industry, $13 million at the time, million dollars, a seven-year deal.
That's about $172 million now, apparently.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Bananas. Oh, my goodness. Right? So that was better, apparently, than Neil Diamond and Elton John's deals put together.
Yeah.
But it meant that he could record where he wanted to. He had creative license. And I think this is where he came into his own, and they call it the Stevie Wonder classic period with Songs in the Key of Life, because he could actually write what he wanted and record where he wanted and do what he wanted. And I think that you could see this now, the maturity and all that sort of the freedom to come together. The synergy was there. I think that's really what's happened. He was at his peak, wasn't he?
Well, you know, he is, no doubt about it, a musical just complete genius. You know,
because
he plays all the stuff, and to me, he always sounds like a cross between Prince. Because Prince, of course, played all the records, and Prince probably was inspired by Stevie Wonder, and then Ray Charles, which he got it all from. So, and I always think he's like a gossipful Ray Charles, because Ray Charles was a bit of a bad boy, wasn't he?
Yeah.
You know, Stevie Wonder
was a bit clean, isn't he?
Yeah, he's very.
We were talking about this. Actually.
Yeah, squeaky
he's a
clean.
Nice boy.
And then Prince sort of took over from that type of thing, and I always put them in the same the sort of three people just lining up
very
there.
Independent, and yet you can see the similarities, but I think there's just that groove, and I think sometimes that's where Stevie goes off as well. He gets lost in a groove, and And Prince can to do that. He went off really funky, actually, yeah. didn't he? And he lost me for a while. There are some styles with him that I can't relate to and stuff.
Well, I love Prince. I mean, he's a marvelous artist. You know, marvelous. But I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, this is a great song, beautifully produced. The playing is spectacular. I mean, I went to see him, but it was a lot. You know, it wasn't my first gig by any stretch of imagination. A long time went to see him at Glastonbury. And he was incredible, you know. There must have been about 40 musicians on the stage. And everything, you could hear everything. The sound system was great. But, the MD, which was a big black guy, sat there. And I think he was the bass player, actually. I just can't remember his name right. But he was the MD. And he was there. And the whole band were as tight as, it was unbelievable.
Yeah,
you know,
that's how you do it.
Yeah, and with all those musicians, it's like having an orchestra, you know. But the grooves, amazing. But it was a great day.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked her way across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side. She was everybody's darling, but she never lost her head. Even when she was given head, she says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls go doot 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 doot. Gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey Joe, take a walk on the wild side. Sugar Plum Fairy came and hit the streets, looking for soul food and a place to eat. Went to the Apollo, you should have seen him go, go, go. They said, hey sugar, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. All right. Ha. Jackie is just speeding away. Thought she was Jim Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that fashion. Said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doot 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 doot. Do 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 do
luscious Lou Reed, Walk on the Wild Side, from his second solo album, Transformer, which was released on the same day as the double A-side single with Perfect Day on the 8th of November 1972 and on the RCA record label. Can you imagine that? Perfect Day and Walk on the Wild Side
and Transformer, all on the same day.
Flipping Nora.
I mean, that's like Christmas come early, isn't it? Lots of chocolate.
Well, I know quite a lot about this because because I've recently read Norman Sheffield's book on Trident and Trident Studios. This was recorded at Trident.
Of course.
And Norman Sheffield was the owner of Trident. He started it all off. And remarkable studio. It's a remarkable book, actually. It's well worth, quite sad at the end, but it's when you see the whole thing that they did at Trident, it was unbelievable. And this is a perfect example of a marvellous recording because they always had the best gear. They were always known for the best gear in the world. People come, you know, came from all over the world to record there. And, of course, David Bowie and Mick Ronson produced this. Of course, it was Ronson.
This is so exciting.
Yeah, but Ronson produced it because Bowie was suddenly floating around somewhere else. And it's just a great... And I know, again, it's a bit of a Radio 2 sort of song, but it's not... You know, it shouldn't be on Radio 2. It's too important to be on Radio 2. It's like, it's just magnificent. The vocal, the lyrical content, the melody, and of course, the bass.
Of course,
talk
Mr.
to me
Herbie.
About the bass, baby.
Herbie
go on, talk
Flowers.
To me about, go on. And
wow.
What happened?
Well, he got played a flat fee of £17 back in the day. That was equivalent to about 200 quid nowadays.
No.
Yeah. It was the bass hook. He wrote the bass hook. It was a double bass overlaid by a fretless electric. I've seen quite a few of the interviews with him when he talks about that. And I just think he's so... I mean, he makes the song.
Of course
he
does.
He really does. And it's so smooth. And he's so cute. He's such a lovely man, isn't he?
He is. And the reason why he put two basses on is he got double the fee, didn't he?
Well, this is what... See, that's what I thought. But then I saw another documentary, one interview, when he didn't confess that bit. So
no.
I'm not quite sure whether or not... Because that's what I thought.
Well, we watched the documentary a few... We need to watch it again, actually.
Yeah,
it's a great... I mean, the whole album's fantastic, the Transformer. And
wow. And, I know. I mean, a Perfect Day is just... stunning. I mean, it was a worldwide hit, double A single as well. It went to number 16 on the Billboard Hot 100 singles charts in early 1973. And the thing is though, it got through some of the censors.
Yeah.
In the UK, because it was really risque at the time. Because like,
Lou Reed, it's risque now.
Well, I know, but Lou Reed was saying that he said, this is a quote, "I always thought it would be kind of fun to introduce people to characters that maybe hadn't met before or hadn't wanted to meet." So you've got like taboo topics like transsexual people, drugs, male prostitution, and oral sex. And in the United States, RCA released the single using an edited version of the song without the reference to oral sex. But in the UK, apparently they were unfamiliar with the term giving head, so they passed it.
That's right, the BBC, like, that's right.
And also, but it's a documentary about life as well, because it's like these are real characters, because there were a lot of them from Factory, weren't they, with Andy Warhol at the time. So you've got Hollywood Lawn, Candy Darling, Joe D'Alessandro, Jackie Curtis, and Joe Campbell, referred to in the song by his nickname Sugar Plum Fairy.
Well, there we go. Joe Campbell?
Yeah.
Not our Joe Campbell.
No, I was going to say, not our Joe Campbell.
Because there's a philosopher called Joe Campbell as well, isn't there? Isn't it? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the backing vocalists, I love that. They were called the Thunder Thighs.
Well, I know. It's a remarkable thing. I wonder if they were Thunder Thighs. But when you hear that vocal, the do-do-do-do-do, right? I mean, I think he said that it would be how he was remembered in
his obituary. It's already
but
written.
But what I love is the fact it comes out of reverb. So it starts off with loads and loads of reverb on that vocal, and then the reverb gets taken up in the level, so it goes dry, you know what I mean? So
it starts
in reverb, and it really brings it out. It's a beautiful technique, really beautiful. We'll be right back.
Chicago and 25 or 6 to 4 from the second studio album, Chicago 2, released on the 26th of January 1970 on the Columbia record label, where it went to number 4 in the US album charts and was an immediate hit.
Well, it sounds surprising. It's a great song. Great song. Some whittering guitar there, which always makes me laugh. The and, you know, I mean, for that time, though, you know, the again, I always say this about American records, the production values were far different. I mean, the drums on this don't sound as good as a normal American record. Now, and thinking about it, they sound very much like the Moody Blues. They're a bit of a cardboard, you know, they're not a great, sounds like you're in cardboard boxes. But it's a great song. And it's all about the horns, isn't it?
Well, it was really weird. You know, at the end when it slowed down.
Yeah.
And it's D and all that kind of discordant notes that we put together. And I almost could imagine a 1970s TV show where it goes, "And welcome to Mr. and Mrs." You know, it had that kind of TV show, like, build up to Morecambe and Wise, the show.
It's a bit odd, but it's great. And, you know, the last note is a really odd note to finish on. But James William Guercio, I think he's called, who produced
Guercio,
it. Yeah. He worked with the Beach Boys later on and Blood, Sweat and Tears and the Buckinghams and stuff. And but I don't really know an awful lot about this band. It's just the fact that we've got the record and we put it on. We dug it out the other day and it's like there and you think, wow, what a great song.
But you know what's really weird about Chicago, though? I mean, this album, by the way, was nominated for 3 Grammy Awards.
Well, yeah.
And one of them was for the best album cover, album of the year and a contemporary vocal group. I've always, always loved Chicago's harmonies.
Yeah, they're great.
I mean, it's just so, I mean, later on, I mean, a little bit cheesy, but really just, this is beautiful, beautiful songs. And
but again, it's that American thing, isn't it? You know, those very tight, smooth harmonies, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash, all that stuff. And they were always really good at that, you know.
But they were a little bit middle of the road. And in a way, it's like, you know, something that your older brother would probably like a bit more straight, as it were.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. You can't fault them. I mean, I really, really like the band. And I think they have a really important place in musical history. I didn't know, however, that they were originally called the Chicago Transit Authority.
Neither did I.
But that was album one. But they had to change their name because they were going to be sued by the real Chicago Transit Authority.
Which I assumed run all the buses and trains and stuff in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really weird. And also I didn't know that Columbia Records, they were very active in promoting, obviously, their quadraphonic four-channel surround sound format in the mid-70s.
Blimey.
And 9 of Chicago's first 10 albums were made available in quad.
Is that right?
Yeah. Now, that's a trivial fact of some substance.
Well, if you remember when we were looking for a console, we went to see that Cadillac, and that was in quad, and it had the joystick.
I love the joysticks; they look so cool.
Yeah,
so retro.
Yeah, and then eventually, you know, of course, you get into 5.1 now. You know, where all the theatre stuff's done, and you know,
I've got another thought as well. It's really obscure, you know, because we recently watched the Ozzy Osbourne.
We did,
yeah, documentary. And we've been playing some Black Sabbath as well. Now, if you listen to the melody of this song, it almost sounds like you could hear Ozzy singing it for the first album because it's so almost monotone. Waiting for the break of day.
You're good with his voice.
Da, 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 da.
Yeah, but you'd have to have some doom.
I know,
you know, guitar.
But you listen to it again, right? When you listen to it again,
yeah, okay.
Just imagine Ozzy singing that. Tell me, oh.
Neville Brothers and Yellow Moon, the title track from their album, surprisingly enough, Yellow Moon, released in 1989 on A&M Records. What do you think about that, Lem?
Wow. All I know and all I ever remember is that it was produced by our friend Daniel Lanois.
My favourite producer in the whole wide world.
Indeed.
I love him.
Indeed. And so therefore... to me, the Neville Brothers, this album, it's all about Daniel Lanois and them and their friendship and him getting on a bike and moving to New Orleans and setting up a studio on the move and just hanging out and recording some amazing albums through over
well,
those
the three
years.
Albums he recorded there, Acadie, which is the Daniel Lanois' first solo record, and this one, and Bob Dylan's Oh Mercy.
Yes.
And... they are magnificently produced, magnificently recorded, magnificently mixed, magnificently played. In fact, they're just magnificent. I mean, the Neville Brothers are mega cool.
They are.
They're so incredibly cool. They're like a giraffe cool. That's that cool, you know. They're just like a big roaring lion cool with a big mane, you know. That sort of cool. Fantastic. And every time Aaron Neville opens his mouth, it's a beautiful, beautiful sound. But when you see him, you just can't connect him.
No, you can't, can you?
He's a big muscle. He's got scars all over him. He's a big lad, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, he is.
You know, and he looks like he's going to tear your head off. And then he just opens his mouth and it's just the most incredible voice.
It's just beautiful. There's some stuff that I didn't quite understand all the detail of, but apparently Daniel bought some studio equipment, especially for this project with the Neville brothers. And he installed it in a 5-story apartment building alongside the Collins Hotel on St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans. Then he relocated to 1305 Sonnet Street to record the Bob Dylan, Oh Mercy.
Which was like a bungalow, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And in Here Is What Is,
we
watched it the other night, the documentary.
Fantastic.
Alain Wilde's documentary, yeah. It's amazing. It really gives an insight into his production. It's something everybody must watch, really. If you're into music and that sort of thing. It's a bit arty in places. His book is fantastic as well. We've read the book.
I like him, though. You really get to know him through the book more so, I think.
Yeah, because he's a very spiritual guy. And
yeah.
I think he really connected with New Orleans, very much so, because Brian Blade, of course, he was playing with on and off over the years, who's a friend of one of our mates, Jordy Rossi, who's a drummer as well.
Yeah.
Brian Blade's drummer. And but the whole thing, it's just an amazing thing. And also playing guitar on this record and keyboards is our friend Malcolm Byrne, who actually we know through the internet, and he's like an associate producer for Supertone. He's a great guy. We haven't actually worked with him yet. We've talked about it a lot.
Well, we're waiting for that right project.
But yeah,
we're
waiting for that right project. But Malcolm Byrne, he's a lovely, very super cool guy, you know.
I mean, I think that's what's really struck me about Daniel and Malcolm, and when you do get pockets of this as well, but it's very much about the music. I mean, I remember reading about Daniel Lamar just going off and taking himself off into a village for a few months, you know, and just listening to sounds and just being peaceful, and you could really tell that he's got a passion, and he didn't set out to do this. He just became more and more useful to musicians, because he's a musician himself.
That's right.
And a
great guitar player and great songwriter.
Exactly. So he didn't set out to be a producer, and he started off really early working with his brother in the basement of his mum's house.
That's right.
And then he met Brian Eno, and then he started working with Eno, and all these things took off. But for me, no matter how high or well-known the calibre of the artist is that he's worked with, what really strikes me about Lamar is his complete devotion to the music.
Yeah, I think sometimes he gets a bit of a bad rep, because I think he's got an air of sort of arrogance about him a little bit, I suppose. And, you know, I mean, he's produced some amazing records. So Peter Gabriel, a lot of some Unforgettable Fire, U2. He's done a lot of work with U2, you know, and multi-Grammy winning records, and his own records are fantastic, you know. So he has got a point, you know, because he is great. But I think he does upset artists sometimes. Some artists don't like working with him, because I think he's a bit too forceful. He's a little bit too much. But, you know, on the other hand, he does some amazing work. I mean,
and
he worked with Andy Lou.
But he also maximises the room. So instead of trying to bring people in or call London, no, he'll actually look at who's in the room and try and work together to get the best from people and get something happening, which I love.
That's a great expression, called London, because that's one thing. Because you get record producing. I've been in a room when this has happened, and you know, when I've been playing sessions and stuff, and all of a sudden he'll go, "Call London," and the drummer is instantly fired, or the bass player's out the door, and they get somebody, some rocket backside from London, you know. And that's it. Anyway, but just to sort of finish this, what I do like about Lamar is he sets up in different locations, and he goes around the world, just sets up his studio, and it's very much like we've done. Like, we've done it in Spain, we're now doing it in Germany, and we just get all our kit, we deck our house up as a recording studio, and then go for it, don't we?
Yeah, we don't really live in a house. We just have a studio that has a bedroom attached.
That's exactly what we do.
Sometimes I wonder how I'm gonna do. There ain't no cure for the
summertime blues. Summertime.
The Who and Summertime Blues, live from their first live album, Live at Leeds, released on the 23rd of May 1970 on the Decca and MCA record labels.
People say this is the best live album of all time. Of course it's not, because Made in Japan.
Everybody's going to say Made in Japan is.
from Deep Purple. But anyway, it was produced and remixed by our friend and co-conspirator John Astley, who mastered
Blueberry Pie,
and the knife. Yeah, he's an excellent mastering engineer and a great guy. And I knew him years ago. He's a very, very cool guy. And but it's a great, you know, it's great energy and great song. The Who. But I think it's probably one of the best records, really, as far as The Who. I'm not a huge fan of The Who, really, but it's great. You know, you can hear everybody doing the stuff on that, can't you?
Well, what struck me about this track was that I thought it would be faster. It seemed to be quite slow in its pace. Mm. And the story goes that it was recorded live at Leeds University in the refectory on the 14th of February 1970.
Yeah.
And the day after they went to Hull, because they wanted to have some live recordings. They wanted to release a live album and they weren't happy, but some of the bass hadn't been recorded properly at Hull, so they were just restricted to Leeds.
Right.
And then Pete Townsend was going to do a double album and he ended up just doing six tracks. I think he just played it safe, or it represented what they wanted to achieve anyway.
Well, it's a great record. I mean, no doubt about it. All right,
darling,
come to the end of the show.
We've
no.
10 seconds. Whoa. Thanks so much for joining us. And get in contact with email and
Mixcloud
Instagram
and all those things. iTunes. See you next week. Bye.
Bye.